From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Twenty years ago, when George Romero made the horror film Night of the Living Dead, Variety questioned the integrity of the filmmaker and the moral health of his audience. Now the film is considered a horror classic. On today's Fresh Air, Romero tells us about his new movie, Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear. Former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara was one of the chief architects of the war in Vietnam. Washington Post reporter Paul Hendrickson is writing a biography of McNamara. But McNamara is such a big and such an elusive subject, Hendrickson has considered abandoning the project. Coming up, a look at this work in progress. Also, we review HBO's new TV series, Vietnam War Story, and jazz singer Betty Carter's new album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In Night of the Living Dead, George Romero's 1968 horror film, corpses rose from the dead to feast on the flesh of the living.
This is the latest disclosure in a report from National Civil Defense Headquarters in Washington. It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder. A widespread investigation of reports from funeral homes, morgues, and hospitals has concluded that the unburied dead are coming back to life and seeking human victims. It's hard for us here to believe what we're reporting to you, but it does seem to be a fact.
George Romero made Night of the Living Dead on a shoestring budget, working on the weekends. It became a cult classic and is now in the archives of the Museum of Modern Art. Night of the Living Dead had scenes that were very graphic for the time, shots of zombies munching on arms and internal organs. But in terms of state-of-the-art gore, it was nothing compared to the two sequels Romero directed, Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead. Romero also directed Martin, about a teenager who thinks he's a vampire, and Creepshow, the film anthology of Stephen King's stories. Romero's new movie is a thriller called Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear. It's about a monkey who is trained to help take care of a quadriplegic and takes over his mind as well. This movie doesn't have the gore Romero fans have come to expect. I asked him if he intentionally made the change.
That's not what I was looking for when I started the project. This was based on a novel, and I had just seen a 60 Minutes report about the Helping Hands program, which is the real-life program that puts monkeys in homes with the handicapped. And within days of that, Charles Evans sent me this novel that he had bought the rights to, and I guess because of having seen the television show, and I was attracted to it, and so I read it carefully, and then I just loved the themes that were in it, and I fell in love with the project itself, and it just really didn't call for very much blood.
Would you feel like you've worked with a different set of muscles for this movie?
No, you know, it's funny. You never really get a sense of that when you're doing it. The real difference that I feel or that I felt when I was on the set was not the fact that we didn't have to, you know, buy all that 3M stage blood, but that it was just a slower paced story. The real effect that I think you feel as a director is the difference between what is an action film, essentially an action film, and this, which is a lot more subtler and suspenseful. And
there's a lot of psychological suspense in it that keeps building as the movie goes on.
Yeah, so texturally, the difference is between the just the pace. It's the, mm-hmm. This isn't a shoot 'em up, which essentially the zombie films are more are westerns, you know.
Do you see this as an updated version of the Scientist in the Laboratory movie, you know, where the scientist is performing a secret experiment on a living creature?
Well, there's a little bit of that, and it's very hard for me to keep a straight face when I'm making a film, and so I like to sort of I use a lot of, I hesitate to use the word homage because it's been used so much, but I use a lot of references, shall we say, to other directors and to the genre in general, and so I tend to do that. I think maybe some of the angles on the scientist in the lab and some of the things that I was just doing visually to recall a more old-fashioned style of film, maybe is what's making you think of that. I mean, this is a story about science run amok, I guess, but mm-hmm. It's really much more about the result of it, than it doesn't dwell at all on the scientist or on the, and it doesn't rely the way the original Frankenstein did on fancy sequences in the lab, if you will.
Well, I don't think I'm giving away too much to say that the scientist is injecting monkeys in his laboratory with human brain tissue to see if they get smarter.
Yeah.
And when his friend is paralyzed in an auto accident, he donates one of his monkeys to a special program which trains the monkeys to assist the physically handicapped.
Right.
Now, I was really wondering, I know the monkey that you cast for this role is actually from the Boston Helping Hands program, which trains monkeys to work with the physically handicapped.
Right.
How did they react to you saying, well, we'd like to use one of your monkeys for a horror film that will scare the dickens out of anybody who's using these monkeys?
Well, this monkey is not actually working in the program. It comes out of the program.
Right.
There's an interesting story. Alice Levy, who owns Boo, who is the star of this movie, one of the stars of the movie, plays the role of Ella. The Helping Hands program actually puts their monkeys out for adoption. They're born and raised at Disney World right now. Most of them are.
And what a life!
Yeah. When they're very young, they're put up for adoption, and they like people with active homes with children to take them in for adoption. And the monkey will live with someone for 3 years. This is to get the monkey used to living around humans and around a home where there's a lot of activity, to make it less skittish, to make it less afraid of human behavior. And then if you adopt one of these monkeys, you sign papers which says, I will give this monkey back, I promise, at the end of 3 years. And what happened was Boo was one of these adopted monkeys, and Alice fell in love with it and was hoping that she didn't have to give it back. And I guess we came along sort of right at the right time. The monkey got the role in the movie, and the producer agreed to replace the monkey so that Alice could keep Boo. And I don't think that Boo will ever work in the program. Boo is probably going to remain a house pet.
You have a disclaimer at the end of the film saying that no monkeys were harmed in any way in the making of this movie.
Right.
And I wonder why it was really important for you to get that on the screen.
Well, I felt that it was important. There was such a furor over Project X, and I think that people are naturally suspicious because of that when they see an animal picture. These animals were very loved. Their trainers were their owners. They do come out of the program. The other monkeys that we were using, most of the other monkeys we were using were actually from the program. There was really nothing going on with these animals that was in any way traumatizing them or hurting them. You know, when they... The scenes that look traumatic were done with either puppets or with, you know, some other kind of movie trickery.
My guess is film director George Romero, whose new film is called Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear. Okay, so what did you use for the human brain in the laboratory?
Those are things that you can buy. You know, there literally are catalogs, scientific catalogs that you can, you know, that supply things like that to.
Like real human brains?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't think that was a human brain, though, but it was, I think it was...
Fooled me.
Okay, yeah. It looks real. It's some kind of brain.
You know what one of the real scary scenes in the movie is? Where the guy who's become paraplegic is in his wheelchair, and his mother comes to visit, and she's showing him home movies of when he was a kid, and there's nothing he can do about it.
Yeah, well, that's the first... I mean, that's really part of what we're trying to set up, is not only the frustration and the tragedy of having that condition, or trying to indicate what the kinds of things that you have to overcome trying to put the audience in the position of experiencing enough of that to sympathize. So it's selecting things like that might be the most bothersome. And also trying to show things that the monkey could possibly help with, like when he drops his mouth stick and he mm-hmm. can't get himself a drink and can't feed himself and things like that when the monkey is introduced, the monkey can help him to do.
You know, I think an audience brings certain expectations to a horror film. When I went to see your movie, I figured, well, everything looks pretty cheerful so far. Any minute now, something really terrible is going to happen. And sure enough, before the credit sequence is over, something terrible does happen. How do you work with audience expectations in a horror film? Do you feel that you can play off of them?
Well, they're there. You know, I think that most of the people that walk into the theater have either seen the poster or seen the trailer, and they know what to expect. In a certain sense, that makes it difficult with a film like Monkey Shines, which develops slowly. There's a lot of story that has to be told before we can get down to the nitty-gritty part of the horror, if you will. And so people that are coming for the pure horror experience have to wait a little longer in this film than they might normally have to do in a film of mine or in a film like Friday the 13th. This is a much more story-oriented film. It's also not that kind of horror film. It's much more of a psychological sort of suspense. It's a suspense thriller rather than a pyrotechnical horror film with a lot of elaborate special effects. It's not a particularly bloody film. It's not a bloody film at all, in fact, and it's much more of a psychological thriller. So I think with that kind of story, people are more willing to wait. I don't think that it's quite the same crowd that's coming in just for the thrill of the ride.
But you still know things are going to go wrong.
You know things are going to go wrong, and there are little clues and little hints that indicate you shouldn't get yourself all too comfortable in your seat. But as I say, it's not pyrotechnics that you're going to experience. It's much more of a psychological, it's suspense. A couple of jumps, but it'll just, I hope, keep you wondering what's going to happen next.
You used a symphonic score composed by David Shire.
David Shire, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I thought it was very refreshing, actually, to hear a symphonic score. I have nothing against electronic music, but there seems to be this generic electronic score that is circulating for a lot of movies nowadays.
Yeah. Well, I was thrilled to be able to get that kind of score. I think David did a wonderful job with it, and he's an excellent composer. And again, the film is a little bit of a throwback that way. I mean, it has we went purposely for a sort of an old-fashioned look to it, a Technicolor kind of look, and it's in general we were hoping to give it that kind of character.
The film has a pretty surprisingly upbeat ending. Without saying any more about it,
right.
Your films usually have very bleak endings.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if this is the ending that you wanted or an ending that was kind of agreed on with the studio, because I know sometimes studios do insist on certain endings.
Yeah, it was agreed on not only by between myself and the studio, but it was myself and the studio and about 1,200 people that previewed the film that voted on it. And there's this new process with in the movie community, which dictates that you have to preview your film and show it to people and listen to the audience reaction cards and so forth. And I had an ending on there which was a kind of a coda. It went for less than a minute long, but it just indicated that back at the university these experiments were continuing. So it's exactly the kind of ending that you're talking about. It was not a particular downer because it didn't affect any of the main characters. It just indicated that out there in the world that the experiment was going on, and therefore there was likely to be another problem someday, somewhere. We got a very really marked audience reaction, negative audience reaction to it, because they just wanted to sort of end the story with the characters that they cared about.
Well, are you outraged that your endings have to be dependent on a popular vote?
Yes and no. Yes. I mean, of course, I would rather just do the film the way I want to do it. On the other hand, it's... you know, it's a big business, and there are people out there that are risking, you know, well, $7 million, in this case, close to $7 million to make the movie, and then, I don't know, it's probably another 7 or 10 again to put it out and make copies and advertise it and all that. And it's so it's one thing to demand creative control. It's another thing when, you know, all these, you know, there's a fiscal responsibility to respond to what the audience wants. And on a certain level, this is why it's so hard to legislate creative controls, because it really, in this country particularly, is a business. And if they can say, well, this is a business, and this business relies on so many people coming to see this, and here are these people who are indicating that they want it to be a certain way, it becomes a tough argument. You know, on the other hand, whereas I think the original ending was a little more literary, and it sort of rounded out a certain part of the story that I felt needed to be rounded out, and I'd rather have the ending on there. However, if audiences don't like it, It's a very tough decision to make. I'm not sure that if I was doing it entirely on my own and without the studio, that I wouldn't have reacted exactly the same way. Just for fear of wanting the, you know, wanting the film to succeed and wanting the rest of the film to be seen. In this case, it's also particularly difficult for me because that ending really had nothing to do. It didn't have anything to do with the main.
Which ending? Your ending or the new ending?
Mine. The one that was taken off. It really is not vital to the telling of the main line story.
Right.
So, and if it was, for example, if someone said you have to change the Night of the Living Dead ending, I think that would have been I would have reacted. In fact, I did. We refused distribution by one company that wanted us to change it.
Boy, it's hard to envision a real happy ending with that movie.
Yeah, well, they wanted the guy to the last survivor to survive. In fact. We didn't. I refused to change that,
right.
But that was something that affected the central storyline. And in the case of Monkey Shines, the little sequence that we took off didn't affect the central storyline at all.
Well, I want to talk with you more about some of your other movies and about your own background. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is film director George Romero. His new film is called Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear. And it's about a Capuchin monkey who is trained to help take care of a quadriplegic and takes over his mind as well. George Romero's earlier films include Night of the Living Dead, Day of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Martin. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
George Romero is my guest. Now, I presume you loved horror films when you were growing up. Did you like them because they scared you, or were there other things in terms of the mood of the movies that you liked a lot?
I liked them principally because they scared me. They were the most fun for me. I think because the things that scare me in real life are always the more realistic things, the fear that someone might drop a bomb on my head or that someone... When I was growing up, I actually went through, in New York City, blackouts when we had to close the windows and worry about air raids. And I don't know whether those were realistic worries or not, but as a kid, when we all had to run around pulling down the drapes and turning the lights off, it was a very frightening experience. And then to think that... I remember when John Cameron Swayze over the television told me personally that the Russians now had the atomic bomb, then I knew that we were goners, you know.
Is that why there's always some newscaster telling about the latest progress of the zombies in your movies?
Probably, yeah. I have a real strong concern for for what electronic media has done to us and bringing us the news as quickly as it does, and not letting us sort of discover things for ourselves or allow them to gestate. You know, it's just a little too. I think it's the pace more than I'm not saying that we shouldn't be brought the news, but it's just the pace at which things are fired at us. I think is maybe a little too fast sometimes.
Can I read something that Variety wrote when Night of the Living Dead came out in 1968? I said, this film casts serious aspersions on the integrity of its makers, distributor Walter Reed, the film industry as a whole, and exhibitors who book the picture, as well as raising doubts about the future of the regional cinema movement and the moral health of filmgoers who cheerfully opt for unrelieved sadism. Until the Supreme Court establishes clear-cut guidelines for pornography of violence, Night of the Living Dead will serve nicely as an outer limit definition by example.
Mm-hmm.
Well, did you feel when you made that movie that you were compromising your moral health or that of your audience?
I didn't feel that way at all. And Night of the Living Dead did, I think, I attribute much of its success to the fact that it was one of the films that people wrote about in those terms. The piece that you just read was one of... 100 pieces that were pleading for some sort of, that was in the period of time between the Hays Commission and the MPAA, which we have now, and there was no governing panel at all that was indicating, there was no censor board, there was no one indicating what, in any fashion, what was to be expected from the content of a film. And, you know, I certainly didn't make Night of the Living Dead for it to be showed at a kiddie matinee. And that was principally what it was criticized for, and I believe that rightfully so, that it shouldn't have been shown at kiddie matinees. That's not who the film was made for.
It's a very extreme film. I mean, I don't think ever before in a movie were zombies shown as explicitly munching on people's limbs. Did you think that the extremity of it would also help get you attention?
You know, the fact is it wasn't nearly as extreme as some of the films that had come out and been made before it. I mean, there were a whole string of films that were, you know, these ghoulie films, or real splatter films that came out actually before Night of the Living Dead. They got narrower distribution and they didn't get as much attention,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't get the same sort of mainstream release.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I spit on your grave, I eat your flesh, children shouldn't play with dead things. There was a whole wave of films that came out that were really much smaller and much more, even though Night of the Living Dead is called a cult film, it's really been seen by too many people to call it a cult film. It really was not. It came out in a very wide release initially.
Did you like all those other films that you just mentioned?
Those kinds of things, as I said, what scares me is the bomb, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so I have never yet been really shocked in my heart and soul. I've never, you know, sat there with my mouth open at any effect that I've ever seen in a movie. And we consciously, all we said to ourselves when we made Night of the Living Dead is, well, let's overstep the bounds of convention and let's not cut away when the monster is about to munch on someone's arm. And so we just didn't. And there's a rather short sequence in the film that shows that. And there's one sequence that everyone points at particularly, when after the two young people are blown up and burned in the car. And that's the sequence that everyone talks about. It lasts for maybe 20 seconds, and there are probably a half a dozen very explicit shots in it. It's not even Grand Guignol to the extent that the sequels that I did were intentionally sort of Grand Guignol. Those sequences were done for the sake of seeing how well we could do them and how shocking we could be. In the case of Night of the Living Dead, it really was not quite that... I didn't think it was quite that gruesome.
Well, Tom Savini, who's done a lot of the special effects for your movie, said in his book that he wasn't happy with how the 3M stage blood photographed in Dawn of the Dead, which is the second in your zombie trilogy. And I wonder if you felt that way, too.
I liked it. And Tom and I will always argue about it. I liked the fact that it looked comic book. Tom felt it looked too bright and red and it didn't look mm-hmm. real. And I feel that helps ease the pain a little bit, the fact that it was more comic book. I like the fact that it looked very comic book.
I'd love to see some of the outtakes from your zombie movies. I figure that there's probably wounds falling off accidentally and blood spurting in the wrong direction.
Oh, yeah. Always have. We have a lot of outtakes. I wish that I could, you know, I wish that you could, I wish I could have afforded to keep it together and even make a little film from some of them. It would have been great. But.
How did you come up with the way you wanted the zombies in your zombie movies to walk? Did you demonstrate for them how you wanted them to look?
No, it's funny. You know, at the moment when you have 40 people in makeup looking at you and you're trying to direct them and tell them what you want them to do, if you make the slightest little arm movement, then in the next shot everyone makes that arm movement. And so if I pretty much leave it up to them and just ask them to do whatever they think a zombie might do if it had just recently come back and had stiff limbs and come back from the dead with stiff limbs. Because if you demonstrate at all, then all of a sudden you get everyone doing exactly that. And the only way that I've found to keep everyone doing their own thing is to let them do whatever they want to do.
I know that a lot of students were in Night of the Living Dead. Have people kept up with you over the years trying to be extras, trying to be zombies in your movies?
Oh, yeah. It's so funny. It's like someone wrote once that there's some kind of a cultist kind of chic to being a zombie in one of these movies. I don't know. I'm always amazed at people that call and say they want to come in and they want to be a zombie or they want to do a special kind of a shtick or a special kind of business. We haven't been able to accommodate as many people as have requested to come in. So it's never a problem getting zombies.
Now, I read that when you were 14, you were making a little movie on your own, And you were, I think, arrested for for throwing a burning dummy off a roof for your film. What's the story behind that?
I grew up in New York City, and I lived in the Bronx in a place called Parkchester, and I was shooting with my uncle's 8mm camera, and I was making a movie called The Man from the Meteor, and The Man from the Meteor was ultimately shot with his own ray gun and fell flaming off the roof of the building where I lived in Parkchester. And I set fire to a little dummy and dropped it off the roof without having failed to contact the police and let them know I was going to do this. And so, yeah, I was hauled away by the police and my parents were called, and it wasn't a serious arrest. I didn't have to spend the night in jail or anything, but I was actually taken in.
Did your parents try to put a halt to your filmmaking, or did they support you?
Well, you know, when I was making The Man from the Meteor, they just thought that I was off doing, something that was a hobby. And I thought it was a hobby. I thought movies were made by, by some sort of royalty that was born into the right and privilege to make them. Or they were made by elves off in Hollywood. And when I was growing up, it really was the only place that movies were being made was in Hollywood. And when I went to Pittsburgh to go to school at Carnegie Mellon, I went to study painting and design. And at the school, which had a very active and excellent theater department, the dean at the time convinced me to transfer into the theater department, and that was the first time that I ever had any inkling that, gee, maybe there's some kind of a career, or these are real people that do this kind of thing. It's not anything magic. But even at that time, there was no hardware. Nobody was making films at a university. All we were, a film class at a university in those days was comprised of watching the Battleship Potemkin and talking about it afterwards. There was no hardware. But some friends of mine and myself, when we got out of school, set up a little company to do commercials on film in Pittsburgh, which was, I guess, somewhat audacious. But at the time, even commercials were not being done in small cities like Pittsburgh.
You've said that you've never really been afraid of the kind of images you create. What scares you is real stuff. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, have you ever been haunted by any image that you've created for a movie?
Only to the extent that I've been typecast as someone that makes this kind of movie. And so that's a kind of haunting, I guess. But again, that's reality. That's not anything, that's not part of the fantasy. No, I haven't been.
Anything you'd be too squeamish to film?
I couldn't shoot news, I don't think. I mean, again, it comes back to that. I don't think I would want to cover, Vietnam. Uh-huh. I don't think I could do it. In the context of fiction, I'm not bothered by it because I guess I feel that it's safe, and I'm always actually a little bit alarmed by the way people react to it. I'm more alarmed by people reacting violently to the violence in my films than I am by the violence in films.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And my guest has been film director George Romero. His new film is called Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear. It's scheduled for release on July 29th, and his other movies include Night of the Living Dead, Day of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Martin, and Creepshow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with journalist John Herr. His new book, And the Wolf Finally Came, analyzes the demise of the steel industry in the United States. Herr is a senior writer at Business Week. He worked in a steel mill as a teenager, growing up in the Monongahela Valley in Pennsylvania. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Paul Hendrickson is in the middle of writing a biography of former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, the man Hendrickson calls the authority figure of the Vietnam War. But the war is the subject McNamara refuses to talk about. Coming up, Hendrickson tells us a little about what he's learned so far about McNamara, and why he seriously considered giving up the book. The war in Vietnam is still being fought on television. There's a new cable anthology series called Vietnam War Story. Television critic David Bianculli has a review. And jazz critic Evan Whitehead has a review of the new album from Betty Carter. Even though her instrument is her voice, Whitehead calls Carter one of the greatest jazz musicians around. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Iran announced today it is accepting United Nations Resolution 598, calling for a ceasefire in its 8-year war with Iraq. That war has killed an estimated 1 million people on both sides. NPR's Barbara Mantell reports on Iran's decision.
The United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 598 1 year ago. Iraq accepted the resolution, but until today, Iran did not. Iran had said that before it would do so, the UN would have to label Iraq the aggressor in the war. Apparently, the Iranians have dropped that condition. Secretary General of the UN, Javier Perez de Cuellar, said at a press conference that he will begin talking today with the Iranian and Iraqi ambassadors to the UN to work out the implementation of Resolution 598.
If I am lucky, I may have a ceasefire, say, in one week or 10 days.
In addition to a ceasefire, Resolution 598 calls for a return to pre-war borders, something nearly accomplished at this point. The resolution calls for an exchange of prisoners of war. Perez de Cuellar says he intends to send a team to talk with prisoners in both countries by the end of this week. And the UN resolution allows for the appointment of an impartial commission to investigate which country was responsible for the war. Perez de Cuellar offered no timetable today on this last point. In New York, I'm Barbara Mantell reporting.
Attorney General Edwin Meese said today a 14-month investigation of him by independent counsel James McKay was a huge waste of taxpayer money, and that implications in McKay's report that he acted criminally are groundless. Meese blasted McKay after the special prosecutor asserted the attorney general probably did violate conflict of interest laws and the federal tax code. Jesse Jackson and aides close to him say they are satisfied with today's meeting with nominee apparent Michael Dukakis. The 3-hour session appears to have achieved the unity the Democrats are seeking as their national convention got underway this evening. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has more.
Jackson did not go to Dukakis with a list of demands. Instead, he sought a role for himself and his supporters in the campaign for the general election and beyond if Dukakis wins. Today, Dukakis said he wants Jackson to play a major role in the campaign, saying Jackson is essential to a strong team that could win the White House. Jackson said he never wanted a job, a title, or a salary from Dukakis. Instead, he said he wants the Democratic Party to make room for the progressive wing he represents. At a briefing late this afternoon, top aides in both camps said there would be an immediate increase in participation by the Jackson forces in the Democratic National Committee, and that Dukakis would emphasize issues like an end to apartheid in South Africa, issues that have long dominated the Jackson campaign. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Atlanta.
A U.S. Navy helicopter exploded and crashed into the Pacific Ocean today off San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge. Apparently, all 8 crewmen were killed. Bruce Bellingham of member station KQED reports.
Crewmen of a fishing boat 11 miles off the Golden Gate Bridge reported hearing explosions before the Navy chopper plunged into the sea. An extensive search of the area is underway, but Coast Guard officials say it appears all 8 crewmen are lost. The cause of the explosions is not known. 7 flight helmets were recovered this afternoon among the scattered wreckage on the water. The search is complicated by heavy fog that has reduced visibility to 150 yards. The helicopter was attached to Squadron 15, based at Alameda Naval Air Station on the east side of the San Francisco Bay. Navy officials say it was conducting a mine countermeasure training operation. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Bellingham in San Francisco.
Stock prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 11 points to close at 2117.89. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In jazz, musicians often want their instruments to sound as direct as voices, while many singers try to phrase like horns. Jazz singers, who can both improvise and interpret a lyric well, are rare. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the best of the few is Betty Carter.
Hello, B-E, that spells love, and love is what I got for you. K-I-S-S, that spells kiss, and I got loads of kisses, too. I don't know why, but what means a lot. If it's love you want, then you can have all I got. All I got is just a lot of romance for a guy like you. Although I'm fine, I'm not the man. I'm trying to prove my love is true. It would please me if you squeeze me tightly in your arms tonight. Say you love me, say you need me. Give my heart a thrill. Oh, honey, please. Say you'll never stop. If it's love you want, then you can have all I got.
Betty Carter's old nickname is Betty Bebop, and like other bop vocalists, she'll scat sing an up-tempo line or end a solo on a flatted fifth. But Betty Carter remembers that bop pioneers didn't just run harmonic obstacle courses at insane speeds. They also went in for excruciating slow ballads. At a slug's pace, a player can't hide behind mere technique. That's what separates a giant like Betty Carter from vulgar bop harmony groups like Manhattan Transfer, who are long on flash but short on spontaneity. On Carter's new album, Look What I Got, on the Verve label, her backing bands give her the room she needs to move in any direction she likes, which she does. Listen to Betty Carter on her sly ballad, Just Like the Movies. The way that she shapes her notes, explores the harmony, and paces a performance show why she's an improviser of the highest order.
Circling the globe on a plane without him. Trying to go to sleep. That possibility slim. I'll be home tomorrow. I can't wait to know if he still feels the same as I do. I hope he hasn't changed a thing. Even if he has, I won't be surprised. That's what time will do. Out of sight, out of mind. Hope I'll be lucky. He'll look in my eyes. I'll hear music in the background. Then he'll kiss me. Just like the movies.
That's Betty Carter with saxophonist Don Braden and pianist Stephen Scott, Ira Coleman on bass, and Lewis Nash on drums. Carter isn't content to be merely a great improviser. She also writes or digs up superior songs you've never heard of with melodies she can toy with. She never sings a lyric the same way twice. Carter may be the best actor in jazz, too, and her interpretive skills and musical grace complement each other in paradoxical ways. On That Sunday That Summer by George Weiss and Joe Sherman, the actor Carter is totally convincing as a woman swept up in love, but the improviser Carter leaves no doubt she's fully in charge.
If I had to choose one day to live my whole life through, it would surely be that Sunday, the day that I met you.
our whippoorwills were calling from the hills. Some of us coming in fast. Lots of daffodils were showing off their skills, nodding all together. I could almost hear them whisper, go on and kiss him, go on and kiss him. If I had to choose one moment to live within my heart, it would be that tender moment, the moment that we started. Darling, it would be when you smiled at me.
There are other great things about Betty Carter, like her ear for fresh talent. Her other rhythm section on her new album is Benny Green, Michael Bowie, and Wynard Harper. Carter always dominates the music, but she still thinks not like a singer with accompanist, but like a member of a band. The rhythmic interaction between her and her fellow musicians is so immediate and unmistakable, you know she's making it up fresh every time, which makes the rich complexity of her music even more astounding. Which is why Betty Carter is one of the greatest jazz musicians on any instrument.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Betty Carter's new album, Look What I Got, on the Verve label.
Looking, looking, looking. It's been a long time coming, Mr. Gentleman.
This is Fresh Air. When Paul Hendrickson began research on a biography of Robert McNamara, the historical record was vast and detailed. In Hendrickson's words, here was a man of three huge careers, president of the Ford Motor Company, head of the World Bank, and Secretary of Defense and architect of the Vietnam War. It was McNamara's tenure as Secretary of Defense that most interested Hendrickson. But where the factual record was all-encompassing, the personal record, the record of McNamara's motivations and inner conflicts, was non-existent. The historical record shows that McNamara lost faith in a military solution early on, but continued to pursue policies that dramatically increased America's involvement and its casualty count. But McNamara has refused to discuss the war, including his loss of faith in a military solution. Hendrickson has found the biography next to impossible to write. He's alternately abandoned and renewed the project with equal determination. This biography in progress grew out of Hendrickson's three profiles in the Washington Post. I asked Paul Hendrickson if he knew at the start that McNamara would refuse to discuss Vietnam.
Of course I did, and maybe that was part of the hidden challenge to try to bring him out, draw him out.
Do you feel like you've gotten a lot closer in the time that you've been writing about McNamara and in the interviews that he's given you with
Well,
him?
I think the kind of writing I'm trying to do, that is a very personal and a humanizing approach, is something that scares him, is something that's difficult for him. Our relationship now, frankly, is pretty much of a non-relationship, which of course has caused huge problems for this book struggle.
And it's difficult for you because you're used to writing very personally about yourself and about other people.
Yes, it is. It is very difficult for me. It's no secret that I have... It's certainly no secret to my wife. It's certainly no secret to some people I work with that I many times have just thrown down all this research and all this endless talk with these people around him and said, forget it, the hell with it. This is the wrong book, the wrong subject. I chose unwisely.
At the time when you decided that you didn't want to write the book,
mm-hmm.
that you were going to stop, what made you, was there a last straw, something that made you say, I've had it, I'm not going to write this, I've just had enough?
Well, when it doesn't seem to be progressing in any rational way, when you stare for long periods at a word processor and nothing is happening, when you seem to be not getting anywhere. But then, you know, you regain strength somehow. You have a good wife who supports you. You come back to your job at the Washington Post and it all becomes synergistic. Success there begins to build on other success. And then you say, well, maybe, wait a minute, maybe I'm not falling out of the sky any longer. It seems, Terry, to be reinventing itself almost perhaps in terms of a group of snapshots, a tableau of a man's life.
Well, a couple of those snapshots have been published in the Washington Post magazine. And one of those snapshots to which you refer is the story of someone, an artist, who in 1972 ran into McNamara on the Martha's Vineyard ferry. And this is a guy who during the war had two brothers in the war. He was an artist who was trying to evade the draft. When he saw McNamara, why don't you explain what he did?
Let me just quickly describe the scene, if I can. McNamara was in the lunchroom. He walked up to him and he said, excuse me, sir, you have a phone call. Please follow me. McNamara immediately set down his drink on the metal counter, turned, and without a word more, followed this man out into the wet darkness. They got on this narrow catwalk between the lunchroom and the pilot house where the alleged phone call was waiting for him. Without a word, the man suddenly turned, got McNamara by the throat and by the belt, and began trying to throw him over the side of the boat. The engines were right down below, and if he had gone in, I don't think he would have had a chance. And even if the propeller had missed him, they were out there in the middle of the open sea. McNamara saved himself with an incredible strength by inserting his hands into the metal grillwork that holds up the ship's railing. So here is a young man trying to shove and push. And as I had written in this piece, what is running through the mind of an arrogant-seeming man whose flesh has gone ice-white in the dark and whose famous wire glasses have been knocked to the floor, but who has managed somehow to interlock his fingers in the sharp metal grillwork of a ship's railing and hold on with something beyond strength, even as a short, insane bull of a figure beside him keeps jamming at his throat with the heel of his hand, keeps struggling to pry the stuck fingers free and finish off the job.
Do you see this as some kind of quintessential incident, some kind of quintessential example of the anger the war in Vietnam generated?
Yes, and if it isn't, then I have no business writing about it. If it's just the act of a bully, if it's the act of a mugger, but I don't see it that way at all, Terry. What I see it about, it that struggle there on the edge of a railing, one man hanging out over the side toward the open water, and the other man, much shorter, jamming at his throat of this huge figure of authority. That, to me, is the Vietnam War. Those 20 seconds, those 30 seconds, that is the Vietnam War between youth, anger, rebellion, confusion. I might also say that this became an item of folklore, cult, but no one ever really bothered to go find out who this nameless but not faceless individual was. And through a long process of search, which I won't bore you with, I found him, and he was there on Martha's Vineyard. And I knocked on his door, cold. I went up without any warning. I thought if I call him or write him a letter, he'll spook. And I knocked on his door, and I said, I need to talk to you. I'm struggling with a book that I'm starting to fail on, and I need you to tell me about the night that you tried to throw McNamara off the ferry. And he looked at me coldly, and he said, how do you know it was me? And I said, Sergeant Welch over at Vineyard Haven said it was you. And he kept staring at me and sort of chewing on his lip, and he said, come in.
You know, you've described McNamara in a way as the ultimate authority figure And it's been my experience that people like that, when you're interviewing them, can be gracious for the amount of time when they want you around, when they're willing to talk, and then you're just kind of cut off. And it's over, their time is up, you're out, and it's a shutdown.
Or, Tara, you asked the wrong question. Have you ever been standing at the racetrack and trying to get up to the $2 window before the bell rings, and the man right before you gets there, that gate, that window just clanks down, and there is no way you're going to get that $2 under the window. I have sometimes experienced that with McNamara. I asked him, when he was beginning to talk about this man, this Quaker who incinerated himself in front of McNamara, 40 feet below McNamara's window at the Pentagon, McNamara movingly and startlingly started to talk about that to me. And I was dying inside because I'm thinking, oh, my God, how can I keep this going? And I then said, by the way, and I think I literally said, by the way, have you ever been down to the Vietnam Memorial? And that $2 window just slammed down, and he said yes, and there was this icy stare, and I said, well, you know, so there we were, hanging in midair, like the man on the ferry boat hanging over the side. I'm McNamara hanging over the side suddenly. I said, well, what was it like? And stammering, I'm sure. And he said, I don't want to talk about it. That's Vietnam. But something in him pushed, some button pushed, and it was over. It was chillingly over.
I really hope you write your book.
Well, that vote of support will not go unnoticed.
You certainly seem really caught up in the material. You know, I'm finding it so interesting hearing you talk about the process of trying to get McNamara to address the war, to address his conscience, that I'm wondering if you're going to really directly write about that as well.
Well, I'm bringing myself into the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the reinvention of it.
Mm-hmm.
I should say this. Again, one needs to temper his words and not sound arrogant. I wish McNamara could unburden himself for himself. You know, our generation seeks the therapeutic response. Our father's generation could not seek the therapeutic response. That's terribly sad.
Yeah. Well, Paul, good luck with your book.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for telling us some of what you've been going through and writing it. Thank you.
Okay.
Paul Hendrickson writes for the Washington Post Style section. This is Fresh Air. Let's look ahead and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne is joining us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Renee.
Hi.
What story are you following?
Well, our top story today, Terry, is that Iran has agreed in principle to accept last summer's U.N. resolution calling for a ceasefire in the 8-year-old war between Iran and Iraq. Also, the long-awaited McKay report was released today. It says Edmeys probably did break the law while in office, but it found that his actions don't warrant prosecution.
And we've got the Democratic Convention convening today.
Yeah, actually, and we have lots of reports and commentary, just to give you a taste. Political correspondent Cokie Roberts reports on the activities in Atlanta. Linda Wertheimer on what it all means for the fall. And we'll talk to delegates.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Vietnam War has been treated in a variety of ways on primetime TV, and television critic David Bianculli says most of the programs have been too sanitized to be effective. But this week, HBO is starting the second season of a Vietnam series that David says has emotional weight.
When Oliver Stone's Platoon was a surprise hit at the movies, you knew TV was going to get around to the Vietnam War sooner or later, and probably sooner. It did. CBS's Tour of Duty premiered last season and did well enough to return next year. The best thing Tour of Duty did was kill off a regular cast member every once in a while, but otherwise, fighting the conventions of primetime TV was almost as impossible as fighting the Viet Cong. Sure, network TV could provide a wartime experience, as long as the language was clean, the drugs were hidden, and Terrence Knox, the star of the show, survived to fight next week. Earlier this year, ABC's China Beach told Vietnam War stories from the perspective of workers at a base hospital. That sidestepped the imminent death problem and seemed a little bit more realistic as a result. But if you're looking for the best TV treatment of Vietnam, the place to go is HBO, where the restrictions are looser and the stories are tighter. While CBS was presenting Tour of Duty, HBO was showing two different programs about Vietnam. One was Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam, the best documentary of that season. The other was Vietnam War Story, an anthology series of three dramas based on actual characters and events. This Wednesday, Vietnam War Story returns for a second season, with enough new episodes to carry through the summer. The first episode has a veteran soldier showing the ropes to a recent transfer. In this scene, the more experienced soldier yells at the other one for looking at family photographs. The language is strong, but that's part of what makes the scene so strong.
The first thing I told you was about not getting too attached to this place. Well, now you see. You're not thinking about here, about what's really going down here. Those pictures you got, if you want to see those kids again, you burn those pictures. You throw them away. If you want to make it back home, you don't think about home. You think about here, and you don't mix them up. Now, you quit this bullshit, taking up for the villagers and playing with little girls. You're going to get them killed, and you're going to get us killed.
Because Vietnam War Story is an anthology show with a new cast and story each week, there's no false sense of security. Any character, even the obvious star, can die at any time. That's one of the series' great strengths and what sets it apart from the network versions. Another impressive thing about Vietnam War Story is that it recognizes there's a lot more to war than actual combat. This week's episode is about the soldiers' relationship to the Vietnamese villagers and army. Next week's episode, set in Honolulu, takes a tense day-by-day look at a young soldier's 7-day furlough with his wife. After days of watching him retreat from her, she finally confronts him when his dress uniform is returned from the cleaners.
There. That's a Purple Heart. I'm not a complete idiot, Russell. My father got one in Korea. You get it for being wounded. And that one has a V on it. It means you did something that almost got you killed.
I was just doing my job, Dee.
Your job? That's a lie. Those few letters that you sent me saying how safe you were, how you did nothing but count Jeeps, you don't get one of those counting Jeeps, Russell.
The actors aren't recognizable, but that's an asset too. It makes the characters and stories more instantly believable. Even if you feel overdosed on Vietnam dramas, try Vietnam War Story. It may be the antidote.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time, a dose of de-evolution with Mark Mothersbaugh and Gerald Casale, co-founders of the rock band Devo. They'll talk about their band's combination of art, theater, electronics, and futurism, and their new album, Total Devo. Also, rock historian Ed Ward examines reggae and why it never really caught on with American radio. And book critic John Leonard reviews Introducing the Great American Novel. It's a collection of essays by and about prominent American writers. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.